son, was sent to the Tower where Henry VI had also been reinstalled. She just had time to get reacquainted with him before he was murdered on the 21st of May, almost certainly by order of Edward IV and very possibly by the hand of his brother, Richard, Duke of Gloucester. Chapter 31. King Edward IV, Alone at Last. Don't think too badly of Edward for killing Henry. By the standards of the time, it was restrained of him not to have topped him much earlier, as soon as he'd been captured. Henry was allowed to last a lot longer than either Edward II or Richard II, the previous deposed medieval rulers, though that was because, while his son and heir were still alive, there wasn't much point in killing him. Margaret's teenage boy was a more dynamic threat to the Yorkist regime than poor Henry. The big news, though, was that in Edward IV, England had found the grown-up it had been seeking since the death of the Duke of Bedford nearly four decades earlier. Edward was a capable king and ruled sensibly until his sudden death in 1483. His major achievement was balancing the books, which he managed by various sensible economic measures, such as not having a civil war and not trying to conquer France. For form's sake, he had to have a small go at conquering France, so he landed in Calais in the summer of 1475. But when his ally, the Duke of Burgundy, failed to turn up in support, Louis XI suggested a deal, and Edward readily accepted. By the Treaty of Pikigny, Louis paid Edward some money, and Edward agreed to go away and shut up about his claim to the French throne for a bit. Edward was capable, tall, attractive, charismatic, and, over matters of state at least, relatively wise. His undoubted military prowess, the strength that had won him the throne, gave him the authority not to turn England into a war state. He allowed some peace and prosperity to creep back. It feels like we should dwell on the many uninteresting things he got right, but the trouble is that they don't matter very much because all of his good work got spoiled soon after his death. If the 1480s had panned out differently, he might have been a Henry II or an Edward I figure, kicking off a whole new phase for his dynasty. He had two healthy, legitimate male heirs, and he was in the prime of life. No one had a better dynastic claim to the throne. Those who arguably used to have one were now dead. The remnant Lancastrian cause was led by the Tudors, all of whose royal blood came through women and was diluted by that of a sexy Welsh bloke who'd caught the eye of Henry V's widow. Edward's only major weakness was his weaknesses. His weaknesses for the pleasures of the flesh, food, wine, and sex. His desire for Elizabeth Woodville, who refused to have sex with him unless he married her, was what caused the most serious mistake he made in the first part of his reign, which temporarily cost him the throne. In the 1470s, the consequences were more predictable, and the strapping warrior of the 1460s morphed gradually, with age and the diminishing requirement to ride into battle, into an obese man who liked taking emetics so that he could throw up and then gorge himself again. It all got a bit flabby and Roman. It didn't seem to affect his political judgment or diminish his mind, but his health inevitably declined. When a serious illness struck him in his early 40s, in March 1483, there was no reason to suspect foul play, though some inevitably did. With modern medicine, it might have been a wake-up call. In the late 15th century, it heralded eternal sleep. He had a couple of weeks to put his house in order and confirm his young son Edward, Prince of Wales, as his heir. Then he died on the 9th of April. Chapter 32. King Edward V. There was no King Edward V. There should have been, but there wasn't. The boy who it should have been was 12 years old when his father, King Edward IV, died. He was proclaimed king, loyalty was sworn to him by many magnates, and then he was taken to the Tower of London. This wasn't necessarily as sinister as it sounds. The Tower was a royal palace, not just a prison, and a good place for young Edward to prepare for his coronation. Then it turned out it was as sinister as it sounds. Edward never left the Tower. He and his younger brother, Richard, Duke of York, were last seen playing there in the summer of 1483, soon after their uncle, another Richard, had been crowned king. Edward and his brother Richard are known as the Princes in the Tower, and at some point in the second half of 1483 they were murdered, probably by order of their uncle. We will never know exactly what happened, which is why this example of the brutality of the world they were born into has captured the ghoulish side of people's imagination. One of the reasons for the focus on the peas in the tea is the subsequent Tudor regime. The Tudors needed to demonise the king they overthrew, and emphasising that he had killed his nephews, one of whom was the rightful king, is helpful to that. That's why, when Henry VIII's son Edward became king, he was named the sixth rather than the fifth of that name to have reigned, other than the three Anglo-Saxon Edwards, who are conventionally ignored, as I keep saying. They wanted to leave a space for little murdered Edward in order to underline how nasty the pre-Tudor monarchy had been. Edward V isn't the only ruler who never was. King Louis XVII and Emperor Napoleon II, both of France, spring to mind. Their notional reigns were also part of subsequent regimes' means of self-justification. Louis XVII was the son of Louis XVI, the King of France when the French Revolution happened, who was executed. But when Louis XVI's younger brother, also a Louis, was plonked on the throne after the Napoleonic Wars, he called himself Louis XVIII as a rebuke to the Revolutionary Republic. He was saying that his little nephew, who had died in prison 2 years after the king's execution, had in truth been a king as well, albeit a maltreated one. When in 1852 Napoleon's nephew, the all-round chancer Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, decided he'd be emperor instead of president of France, he called himself Napoleon III, not Napoleon II, to acknowledge that there was a time when the original Napoleon's son ought to have been ruling if France had been doing the emperor thing at the time. Counting a ruler who never ruled in the numbering system is asserting that monarchy is about more than merely who happens to hold power. Like coronation and anointing, it's part of the claim of God-given legitimacy with which rulers in gold hats seek to minimise the extent to which their power is questioned. Chapter 33. King Richard III. It is impossible to discuss any aspect of Richard III's reign without mentioning the Tudors. In this, their victory over him is even more complete than at the Battle of Bosworth. That battle, in 1485, marked the end of the Wars of the Roses, hooray! And in it, Henry Tudor defeated and killed Richard III and established the Tudor dynasty on the throne, where it stayed for 118 years. That paragraph of spoilers was made inevitable by Tudor propaganda. Our sense of the story of Richard is contaminated by how it ended and what happened next. The Tudors, as we've seen, had a flimsy claim to the throne by blood. The notion of primogeniture, of the reliable passing of the crown from father to son, never felt more distant than when Henry snaffled the throne from his third cousin once removed. Henry justified his nicking of the crown in several ways, and that in itself betrays the dodginess of his claim. As with any excuse for doing something you perhaps shouldn't, it's best to stick to one thing. I was late because the traffic was terrible. I can't come because I've got the shits. These are plausible reasons. But when you say, I need to cancel the meeting because I've got a bit of a jippy tummy and there's a rail strike and my sister's just about to have a baby, it starts to sound desperate. So it was with Henry's complicated justifications for knocking Richard off the throne, which went a bit like this. 1. Richard had usurped his nephew, Henry's fourth cousin, who should have inherited the throne after Edward IV died. 2. Richard was a murderer and had had his nephews killed. 3. And even with them dead, he shouldn't have been king because his elder, though now disgraced and executed, brother Clarence's son Edward Earl of Warwick was further up the line of succession, so should have been king first. 4. Except no, because actually Henry Tudor should be king anyway because he's directly descended from John of Gaunt, just like Henry's the 4th, 5th and 6th were, so he's the Lancastrian claimant. And 5. Henry also maybe should be king because his grandmother was Henry VI's mother. Let's factor that in too. Henry Tudor had a lot of reasons to be king, none of them quite good enough. This was why the emphasis on how dastardly the previous regime had been was so important to the Tudors. Richard's having usurped his nephew and then murdered him was vital to assert because it both showed how horrible Richard was and demonstrated a precedent for killing people and nicking the throne. You can spin it either as, he did that so he shouldn't have been king, or the previous king did that so why shouldn't I? It's well established then that the Tudors worked hard to make Richard III look bad. Too well established. People in modern times got a bit overexcited about it and started to jump to the contrary conclusion that Richard was, in fact, lovely, and that he didn't have a hunchback. The Tudors and Shakespeare made that up. Not that people with hunchbacks can't be lovely, of course, but the Tudors didn't think they could because they were so nasty themselves. So it was probably them that murdered the princes in the tower, not Richard at all. This is a bit of a leap. The lamentable problem that you can't believe everything you're told is not solved by merely believing the polar opposite. We can't know for sure who killed the princes in the tower, or if they were murdered at all, but the circumstantial evidence against Richard is far greater than that against Henry Tudor or any Tudor sympathisers. Plus, even if Richard didn't murder them, he still usurped the throne, so he's not exactly Gandhi. He was definitely king instead of his nephew. The Tudors didn't make that up. If Richard didn't kill them, or order their killing, then what happened? Were they still alive when Henry Tudor took the throne? If so, we have to believe either that Richard kept them locked away, which would have been stupid of him, as it meant that everyone unnecessarily assumed he was a murderer, or that the evidence for every occasion when they appeared in public from 1483 to 1485 was subsequently destroyed by the Tudors, an achievement in misinformation that would have wowed the Stasi. Nevertheless, the notion that Richard was a good man and a fine king, the evidence for whose greatness has been entirely obscured by the horrible Tudors, has proved attractive. It would be brilliant if it were true, of course, if this notorious king turned out to have been the victim of a centuries-long libel and was in fact a sort of statesman come pussycat. But then it would be brilliant if unicorns or dragons or King Arthur turned out to exist. The fact that something would be an amazing narrative twist does not, sadly, make it more likely. Nevertheless, the thirst for this to be the case, where Richard III is concerned, has led to the Ricardian movement, people who are dedicated to redeeming his reputation from the slanders of the Tudors. The most prominent Ricardian group is the Richard III Society, which helped to get what turned out to be the King's remains exhumed on television from under a car park in Leicester in 2012. The skeleton, DNA analysis of which confirmed was Richard's, caused a sensation and a legal battle between the authorities in Leicester, who wanted to reinter the remains in their cathedral, and another Ricardian organisation of descendants from the Yorkist line called the Plantagenet Alliance, who wanted him to be reburied in York on the basis that apparently it was what he would have wanted. I find all this a bit daft. It's nice to take an active interest in history. I've already admitted to supporting Harold of Hastings as if he were a football team. But we don't and can't really know these people. The only meaningful respect we can pay them is to acknowledge that unknowability. The truth is lost under centuries of propaganda and then centuries of contrarian rejection of it. It seems, though, from his skeleton, that Richard suffered from severe scoliosis. So he may have been a hunchback after all. Richard's nasty little reign. Apart from seizing the throne and having his nephews murdered, Richard seems comparatively nice. I realise that apart from clause is doing a lot of work, but the Ricardians are right that if they could only pin the whole nephew murder onto someone else, they're a long way towards rehabilitating their hero. The usurpation is vanilla next to child murder. Several English kings started their reigns nicking the throne and yet comfortably evaded pariah status. Richard still had a fair few other people killed, mind you, but that was mainly for treachery, which is par for the course for a king at the time. They all had traitors killed, and you could even argue that in a medieval context, that sort of firmness in leadership can save lives in the long run. Henry I wasted traitors at the drop of a hat and presided over a nice peaceful reign as a result. Meanwhile, King Stephen could be a bit of a soft touch, and his reign turned into an absolute car crash. Before Edward IV died, Richard seemed like a decent, reliable sort. He was devoted to his brother the king and a capable lieutenant. In this, he contrasted strongly with his elder and Edward's younger sibling, the truculent Duke of Clarence, who caused so much trouble for Edward that finally the king had him attainted by Parliament and discreetly executed in 1478. It's said that this was done by drowning him in a butt of Malmsey, a barrel of sweet wine, a bit like Madeira. But it's probably just a tasty rumour. Richard, in contrast, was loyal and militarily effective. He might have been the person responsible for murdering Henry VI. He was certainly in the Tower of London at the time, but that aside, any aura of darkness is retrospectively imposed. He was exactly the kind of dependable member of the family whom Edward would have wanted to hold the fort during his son's minority, just as the Duke of Bedford had done after Henry V shat his last. Then, when Edward actually died, things changed. The family of Edward's widow, the Woodvilles, had become very influential, and her brother, Earl Rivers, was in charge of little Edward V. Richard, along with other influential magnates such as Lord Hastings and the Duke of Buckingham, were worried that the Woodvilles would use their control of the young king to control the government. So, 3 weeks after Edward IV's death, Richard and Buckingham staged a coup and had Rivers and his nephew Sir Richard Grey, the Queen's son by her first marriage, arrested and executed. That's when the young prince/king was taken to the Tower. It wasn't clear at that stage that Richard meant to make himself king, and maybe he hadn't decided to yet. Moving swiftly against a rival faction was how you survived and succeeded during the Wars of the Roses. But Richard's paranoia grew, and having dealt with the Woodville faction, and with the Dowager Queen seeking sanctuary in Westminster Abbey in fear of her safety, his allies started to drop away. Hastings was suddenly arrested and executed in June, and by October even Buckingham had deserted him, joining a rebellion in favour of Henry Tudor. It failed, so Buckingham too was dead by the end of the year. Richard's initial ruthlessness may have been what he felt was necessary for his own safety. He may have been convinced that in a Woodville-led government he would have been an unwelcome, overmighty subject whom they would take the first opportunity to dispose of, hence his preemptive strike. Having done that, though, he needed to establish leadership that brought in all the other major factions within the kingdom. But he failed to do this, largely because his regime looked like it was founded on child murder, and probably was. The magnates were reluctant to trust anyone who could do that. Executing someone who betrays you was regal and ruthless, and, as long as they weren't minded to be treacherous themselves, could actually make the magnates feel safe. It was harsh but fair. Killing two innocent children in order to steal power was far too harsh and not at all fair. It destroyed trust. Without trust, powerful people started to defect from the regime, which then became too narrowly centred on old retainers of Richard's from his power base in the north. He couldn't take the whole realm with him. Most of the stalwarts of his brother's government were losing confidence in him. As trust diminished, so his paranoia grew and grew more justified. Gradually, Henry Tudor, with his absurd remnant of a Lancastrian claim, a man who had been living in Brittany for years and barely knew England or spoke English, began to pick up support. Yorkist support as well as Lancastrian. Buckingham was an early example, and he failed and got beheaded, but events were moving in Henry's favour. Meanwhile, for Richard, life got worse and worse. In April 1484, his only legitimate son, Edward, Prince of Wales, died at the age of 10. In March 1485, his wife, Anne Neville, died at the age of 28. Rumours then started to spread that he had poisoned her and was limbering up to marry his niece, Elizabeth of York, whom Henry Tudor had already pledged to marry if he became king, in order to unite the Yorkist and Lancastrian lines. Even by the standards of medieval royal weddings, Richard marrying his niece was far too incestuous, and to get a dispensation for that, he'd have to catch the Pope drunk after a big win on the horses. It was fine for Henry Tudor to marry her, though, because he was only marginally more closely related to the royal family than Josh Widdicombe. The general sense of revulsion was such that Richard ended up publicly denying that he had ever had any intention of marrying his niece. Meanwhile, he was making overtures to Francis II, Duke of Brittany, to get Henry turfed out of his long-term place of asylum. But this backfired when Henry fled to Paris and garnered the support of the new French king, Charles VIII. It was Charles who lent Henry the money to assemble an invasion force in the summer of 1485. Henry and his uncle Jasper set sail from Normandy with a small fleet and 4,000 men and landed near Milford Haven on the 7th of August. They marched through Wales and into England, picking up some support on the way. The most significant support they picked up, however, was at the actual battle that Henry fought against Richard at Bosworth in Leicestershire on the 22nd of August. This was from the Stanleys, Sir William Stanley and Lord Stanley, the latter being married to Henry Tudor's mother, Margaret Beaufort. They had turned up at Bosworth with thousands of troops, but undecided as to which side to support. The fact that they plumped for the Tudors at the 11th hour made all the difference, as did the fact that Henry Percy, still 4th Earl of Northumberland, who had arrived with a large force to support Richard, decided not to join in the fighting at all. The confidence in the House of York that Edward IV had earned from the magnates had been wiped out by his brother in little more than 2 years, so that even those who rode to battle with him were willing to change sides or abandon him in the happy event that he looked like losing. Henry, or rather his general, John de Vere, Earl of Oxford, won the day, and Richard was killed. The dead king was then stripped naked, his crown plonked on Henry's head, and taken to Leicester, where he was buried in the Church of Greyfriars, which, in 1538, closed down to be replaced by something, which was replaced by something, which was, insert 500 years of town planning here, replaced by something, which was replaced by a car park. He lay there for centuries until he was discovered by Channel 4, only about 10 years after I was. Chapter 34. King Henry the Seventh. It's the end of the Middle Ages! I expect you know that that's simplistic. The Middle Ages aren't something that ended on a specific date. Still, they have ended, and they did happen. So at some point, the latter state was supplanted by the former. And if you had to pick a year somewhere in that gradual process, 1485 is a reasonable one to go for, but for the disadvantage of having been traditionally cited as the end of the Middle Ages, and so attracting a queue of historians keen to say why that's wrong, which isn't the case for other years that might be far less reasonably suggested, such as 112 BC or 1978. We should enjoy it. Changes in the air. There's a renaissance already underway down on the Med, where it's always nicer, then as now. The paintings are starting to look less wonky. The famous one of Henry VII is quite realistic, though it's strange that he's depicted in a sort of booth with his hands over the edge, rather like a celebrity on blankety blank. In 1476, William Caxton set up the first printing press in England, so more books are becoming available to a more literate populace. Most of the change, though, is yet to come, which is the problem with declaring the Middle Ages over. It wouldn't have felt like they were over at the time. The next century would see the growth of towns and huge expansion in trade, industry, and population. Items such as glass and chairs, the preserve of the mega-rich up to this point, would become affordable by the merely affluent. Feudalism is fading away, and the bourgeoisie is coming. But you couldn't necessarily feel the approach of that change if you were collecting body parts in the aftermath of the Battle of Bosworth. However, something fundamental had changed about the nature of kingship. That's what gradually became clear once the Wars of the Roses ended. It was weakened. People didn't believe in it in the same way. That has nice long-term consequences, like freedom and democracy, but not so great short-term ones. Emerging as it did from the Dark Ages, the lawless chasm that opened up as the Roman Empire contracted, the concept of kingship turned into something that felt eternal and solid and godly. There simply was a king, and that was that. For a long time, it was his coronation and anointing that mainly made him a king. Then the notion morphed a bit, and a man's place in a line of succession based on primogeniture came to feel more significant than an archbishop's deployment of a metal hat and a blob of goo. Either way, there was a strong sense that a king wasn't just a normal person. He possessed an ineffable specialness. But the filthy habit of usurping rightful kings that the English royal family slipped into during the 14th century started to erode that sense of specialness. Everyone knew Henry Tudor was a bit of a random king, including Henry himself. He was the least qualified by blood of any ruler since Harold Godwinson, and he didn't have Harold's knowledge or experience to mitigate the flimsiness of his claim. He might do the job of king perfectly well. That was what everyone was hoping after Bosworth, but if he did, that would weaken the institution further. It would make a mockery of centuries of assumptions about who can rule whom. If Henry Tudor can have a go, anyone can. A few years ago, in an episode of QI that I appeared in, Stephen Fry explained that almost everyone in Western Europe is a direct descendant of Charlemagne, and almost everyone in the UK a direct descendant of William the Conqueror. These were facts based on overwhelming statistical likelihood. Someone of English ancestry living today will have 2 parents, 4 grandparents, 8 great-grandparents, etc. Spin this back 10 centuries, and their number of ancestors hits about 8 billion. many times the total number of humans alive on Earth at that time, let alone in England and Normandy. So a person living now must be descended from a person living then by many, many different routes, not just one. That makes the chances of any given person with any English ancestry at all not descending from William by at least one of those routes so vanishingly small as to be, in practical terms, impossible. Royal blood gets everywhere, basically. Just ask Richard III after a clean-up at the Tower. As soon as the principle of a line of succession is gone and kingship is discussed in Henry Tudorish terms of having a bit of royal blood, then the concept of royalty starts to become meaningless. Kings are reduced to what they started out as, dictators. People don't think the kings are legitimate, and the kings don't feel legitimate themselves. Governmental self-confidence and confidence in government are both undermined. People are governed not with their consent, but through fear. It's not as nice. It feels strange to be saying this about the beginning of the Tudor age, perhaps the most famous era of English kingship. A lot of that fame, though, is because of the paintings and the palaces they left. The Renaissance blasted the image of Henry VIII and Elizabeth I onto the night sky like the bat signal. But that projection of real magnificence, of strength, is a technique for concealing weakness. They weren't Plantagenet and they knew it. By reigning as successfully as they did, they proved that being a Plantagenet had never really meant anything anyway. Anyone can say they're the king. The most interesting consequence of this creeping sense that kingship wasn't really a thing was the advent of a new sort of rival claimant to the throne, normal members of the public. There were two of these in the first half of Henry's reign. They didn't admit they were normal members of the public, they said they were members of the House of York, but they were lying. The first said he was Edward Earl of Warwick, but he couldn't have been because Edward Earl of Warwick was still living in the Tower of London. The second said he was Richard, Duke of York, Edward V's younger brother, but he couldn't have been either, because Richard was also still in the Tower of London, but not living. Their real names were Lambert Simnel and Perkin Warbeck, and they both caused a lot of trouble. Simnel, who had been schooled in his deception by a priest in Oxford, emerged in Ireland, where everyone seemed to believe his story. He was crowned King Edward VI at Christchurch Cathedral, Dublin, with a gold headband that they'd pinched off a statue of Mary. His key sponsor slash puppet master was John de la Pole, Earl of Lincoln, grandson of the de la Pole who was a favourite of Henry VI, but, more relevantly, nephew of both Edward IV and Richard III. His mother was their sister. They invaded with a reasonable-sized army in June 1487, which Henry VII defeated with a bigger army at the Battle of Stoke Field. Lincoln was killed, and the king then pardoned Simnel, giving him a job in the royal kitchens, which at that point he was very grateful for. What is weird, though, is how the fact that Simnel wasn't really a member of the House of York didn't seem to matter to those supporting him, some of whom were members of that house themselves. They were very happy to have a pop at making him king, even though he had no right to it at all. In practical terms, this didn't disqualify him for the role. They were coming perilously close to concluding that a king is just a guy with a gold hat. Warbeck's attempts to gain the throne caused even more trouble for Henry, though he didn't have to fight a battle on English soil this time. Throughout the 1490s, Warbeck was pottering round the continent, gaining support at various times from the King of France, Margaret, Dowager Countess of Burgundy, who was Richard III's sister and the aunt of the person Warbeck was claiming to be, Maximilian, the Habsburg, who was soon to be Holy Roman Emperor, and James IV of Scotland, a very posh bunch. Henry actually invaded France in 1492 to stop Charles VIII from supporting Warbeck and, much like Edward IV 17 years earlier, ended up being bought off with a nice treaty and pension. But still, the Warbeck threat persisted. Wherever he went, people called him Richard IV. Like all conspiracy theories, it started to grow simply because it couldn't be snuffed out. Members of Henry's court, including Sir William Stanley, were revealed as secret Yorkist sympathisers and were beheaded. But Warbeck wasn't a Yorkist really, he was just a guy. Many people must have realised that. Where had this Richard of York been during Richard III's reign, if he was still alive? How did he manage to pop up on the international scene 8 years after he had disappeared? None of it made sense, except in the context of Henry VII's slender claims to royalty. If Henry Tudor can say he's king, why can't anybody? Warbeck was finally captured in the autumn of 1497 after trying to start a Cornish uprising. He was taken to the Tower, where he was treated reasonably and held alongside the Earl of Warwick, the very person Lambert Simnel had tried to impersonate. Warwick and Warbeck formed a sort of mad bond and resolved to escape together. Their failed attempt to do this in 1499 led to them both being executed. Warwick, as genuine royalty, was beheaded at Tower Hill, but Warbeck, who had long since confessed his true identity as a chancer from the Low Countries, had to travel standard class. He was hanged at Tyburn. A centrist rose. Henry Tudor was crowned in some majesty in October 1485. He did this before he married Elizabeth of York, in order to make clear that he had the legitimate Lancastrian claim to the throne and didn't need her permission or bloodline to be king. This was all the more important to emphasise because it wasn't true. He adopted the red rose to symbolise the House of Lancaster. It's a badge that had hardly been used before, though the white one had become a symbol of the House of York. But Henry adopted it on his accession because he was getting ready to launch a new rose in the wake of his marriage to Elizabeth of York and her coronation as queen in 1486. This was the Tudor rose, and it was red and white. That was how Henry intended to spin the House of Tudor, the joining of the two rival sides of the old House of Plantagenet into a new royal dynasty that drew its legitimacy from both of them. By emphasising this truth, he obscured the fact that it also didn't draw quite enough legitimacy from either of them. He was no fool. He was cautious and intelligent, but also paranoid and avaricious. In the first half of his reign, he seemed dynamic and strategically astute while dealing with pretenders and putting together diplomatic marriages. He married his eldest son, Arthur, to Catherine of Aragon, daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, the co-rulers of Spain, and his daughter Margaret to King James IV of Scotland. I'm suspicious of the phrase, "it's hard to exaggerate the consequences of," because exaggerating is easy. That's why we have phrases like "a squillion dollars" and "totally changed the world forever." Nevertheless, if you were to seek to exaggerate the consequences of those two marriages, at the very least you'd need to take a bit of a run-up. Then, in 1502, things started to go wrong for Henry. In that year, Arthur, Prince of Wales, died, leaving the 10-year-old Henry, Duke of York, as his sole heir. Then, in 1503, the Queen died in childbirth. Henry, who showed so few signs of liking anybody, clearly loved his son and wife, as these developments devastated him. He retreated into deeper paranoia and meanness. The thing that's weird about Henry's reign is that he managed to stabilise it despite an almost complete absence of trust between him and his magnates. After decades of civil war, the political community was minded to settle for any regime that wasn't absolutely murderous. Henry's response to nobles who'd aroused his suspicion wasn't usually violent, it was just grasping. He would fine them enormous sums for perceived transgressions, but then say they only had to pay some of the fine and could just owe the rest. A lot of the aristocracy were thereby held in a position of perpetual debt to the crown. This made them wary, and it made them poor, but it didn't make any of them fear for their lives. Henry VII's meanness is reminiscent of Edward II's. In both cases, the treasure the king stockpiled made them feel safe. In both cases, they were wrong, though Henry VII never had to find that out. Money was important to governments, then as now, but also then as now, the more important issue was credit, in both the financial and the political sense, and the two went hand in hand. Monarchs who had trust, who managed Parliament well, also had access to finance. They didn't need to stockpile cash because they could borrow. As stable leaders, they could leverage the enormous wealth of a whole country, not just the resources of the crown and court. Richard I, Edward I and Edward III all spent colossally, but since they were trusted leaders and generals, their financial position was usually secure. It was only when they faltered as leaders, respectively by being kidnapped, losing magnate support over Gascony, and going dribbly and old, that money became a problem. Conversely, for Henry VII, money wouldn't have been a solution. The problems of loss of trust from the magnates, and therefore credit, were not something he could have bought himself out of had he needed to. But he didn't. On balance, and in the absence of any easy alternatives presenting themselves, the magnates were willing to go along with Henry's scam. Particularly as, by the time he really started to turn the screw, his health was failing. They waited him out, and on the 21st of April 1509, Henry died as king. He was rich, lonely, and unloved. Chapter 35. King Henry VIII. When you think of the word king, what image springs to mind? This might be a bad time to ask you. You're listening to a book all about kings. I've been mentioning them like mad. People in crowns will be buzzing round your head like tweeting birds round a concussed cartoon character. Still, I don't think I've got the rhetorical power to drive out the main kingly picture from your mind. Think of a king, and your brain is likely to conjure up a portrait of Henry VIII. It'll probably be one of the Hans Holbein ones, where he's all square. Square ends to his feet, which are planted wide apart, so they're directly underneath his square shoulder pads, framing his big square chest. And plonked on top, his large square head, with beard covering the bottom two corners and hat covering the top two. The slightly jaunty angle of the latter utterly undermined by the extremely unjaunty look on the cruel, piggy-eyed face. He looks a right cunt. In summary, that's what he was. Of course, it's more complicated than that, and the chances are you already know that. He's such a famous king that almost anyone who would ever buy or read a history book in English knows the main things about him. There are six of them, and they're his wives. Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. In retrospect, we should have given them names. I've stolen that line from the great comedian Rob Brydon, who says it after listing his children's ages. It works well for our dismissive relationship with those women. Now, as then, they only seem to matter in terms of their relationship with him. We all know men like that. At least Henry had the excuse of being king. The odd thing about Henry VIII is that we know such a lot about his feelings and desires. He lived his life in public, like a cross between Kerry Katona and Vladimir Putin. We know about his physical vanity, his lusts, his desperation to have a son, the many crises in his love life, his conflicted spirituality, his young athletic sexiness, his embarrassing weight gain and increasing physical decrepitude. His whole chaotic, bad-tempered personal life is still being played and replayed before us. If you visit the Tower of London, you can see his various suits of armour and how they got larger as he got fatter. How embarrassing for him. He was a very proud and self-important man. The thought of millions of people over hundreds of years knowing all about his ballooning waistline, his festering leg wound, and in later life his irascible inability to get it up would have made him shudder and shout and have someone executed. In a sense, knowing all that humiliating detail is part of posterity's revenge. Only part, though. The rest of this book is all about how wrong Henry VIII turned out to be about everything. Nothing he tried to put in place really worked out. Power went in very different directions from those he'd planned. His impact on history was not the one he intended, though he did become very, very famous. The sense we get is of an enormous tyrannical infant, throwing aside chicken bones like toys out of his pram. This vision of the king as child, as spoilt brat, is very influential. It infuses A.A. Milne's poem about King John, and also another great one of his, The King's Breakfast, in which a monarch goes back to bed in a sulk because someone has suggested he might want to try marmalade. Nobody could call me a fussy man. They certainly couldn't. They wouldn't dare. And they couldn't call Henry VIII a selfish fatso going through a midlife crisis. I don't know whether Milne's view of a ruler would make sense without the thought of Henry VIII demanding that his ministers do the impossible and arrange for him to change wives. For me, this idea that he was spoilt is tied in with the fact that he's got exactly the wrong amount and type of entitlement. His father was a self-made man, for all his talk of royal blood. Henry VIII is, in some ways, a typical second-generation waster. Phrases like, he thinks the world owes him a living, spring to my resentful mind, which is strange because legitimate kings are justified in their sense of entitlement. The idea is that the world does owe them a living. They were entitled to be in charge and no one else was. My distaste when Henry VIII exhibits those assumptions is a sign that, heir of his father by primogeniture though he was, he is still tainted by usurpation. A normal bit. The beginning of Henry's reign was quite nice in a boring sort of way. Everyone thought he was very handsome and clever, and he did all the things that were expected of him. He arrested and executed his father's two most unpopular ministers. He married Catherine of Aragon, his brother's widow, who'd been hanging around England for 7 years waiting for that to happen, thereby cementing an alliance with Spain. He formed another alliance with Maximilian, that Holy Roman Emperor who'd been in Perkin Warbeck's Rolodex a couple of decades earlier. He even had a little pointless war with France that went perfectly well, although it didn't achieve anything. While he was away doing that, Queen Catherine ran quite a successful war with Scotland, which did achieve something. The death of the King of Scotland. Henry's brother-in-law, James IV, fell at the Battle of Flodden, so that was nice. While we're on the positives of killing relatives, he executed the main Yorkish claimant to the throne, Edmund de la Pole, brother of the de la Pole who'd been killed at Stoke Field. Known as the White Rose, he'd been in the Tower of London for some time, so he was mainly executed to minimise his chances of escape. There was still another White Rose at large, though. This was Edmund's other brother, Richard, who was swanning round Europe enjoying the hospitality of any monarch who liked the idea of annoying the King of England, which was most of them. This Richard remained a thorn in Henry's, at this point still not particularly podgy, side until 1525, when he died at the Battle of Pavia, fighting unsuccessfully for Francis I of France against the new Holy Roman Emperor and King of Spain, the greatest Habsburg of them all, Charles V. Charles was very important, but, like so many Habsburgs, terribly inbred, in a way that affected his jaw and meant that, for everyone's sake, he usually ate privately in rooms soundproofed to conceal the noise of all the weird slurping. The soundproofing bit is not necessarily true. By then, Henry had attempted to make friends with Francis I, having had a great big camp international summit with him in 1520. I'm calling it camp both in the theatrical sense and because it was literally a great big camp. An enormous camp called the Field of the Cloth of Gold, in which Henry and Francis proclaimed a vacuous bromance that neither of them really felt. Henry wanted to emulate Henry V, his stellar Lancastrian predecessor, famed for his martial valour and piety. A brilliant but thoughtful prince, always on the right side of history. It was in this virtue-signalling spirit that, in 1521, Henry VIII wrote a treatise condemning Martin Luther, who had nailed his 95 theses to the door of a church in Wittenberg to kick off the Reformation. Pope Leo X was grateful for the support and awarded Henry the title of Defender of the Faith, Fidei Defensor, an accolade that the British monarchy boasts to this day, a cool half millennium after Henry rejected papal authority. It's still on all the coins, a little FD or Fid Def, and presumably means that anyone with, say, a CBE who turns Republican is welcome to print those letters on their business cards, even if they're simultaneously plotting the downfall of the House of Windsor. Hope for a Pope on a Rope. Fair Weather, Friend of the Faith, would have been a more apt title for Henry. In 1534, he rejected papal authority and declared himself the head of the English Church. This wasn't quite the same as turning the country Protestant, but the many people in Henry's circle who were in favour of the Reformation delightedly saw it as a step in that direction, even if Henry himself blew hot and cold over ditching tenets of the faith he'd been brought up with. The only two tenets he was totally comfortable with ditching were, one, his having to obey a man in Italy who didn't seem to understand how sexy Anne Boleyn was, and, two, there being monasteries all over the place in possession of lots of land and wealth, which Henry couldn't nab, even though he could think of thousands of fun ways of spending it. Those couple of tenets could go fuck themselves, he felt. Other tenets, like transubstantiation and not letting oiks interpret the scripture for themselves, retained his sympathy, except when Anne Boleyn was looking particularly alluring. I'm getting ahead of myself, because I reckon you know most of this. Anne Boleyn was the second of Henry's wives, whom he married after Catherine of Aragon had got too old to have any more children. Of the several she'd had, only one had survived infancy, and that one, horror of horrors, was a girl. Henry was convinced that he needed a male heir. In this, he wasn't a standout sexist. His was the mainstream view at the time, as there was no precedent for a female sovereign successfully ruling England. Empress Matilda had had a go. Enough said. This crisis was developing in the late 1520s, at the same time as Henry was becoming infatuated with the much younger, than either him or Catherine, Anne Boleyn. He'd had an affair with her sister, Mary Boleyn, but Anne was more aspirational than Mary and wouldn't have sex with him unless they were married. a technique known at the time as doing an Elizabeth Woodville. If Woodville's resolve had caused a few problems and a minor civil war, Boleyn's ended up changing the whole nation's belief system, as well as doing almost as much long-term damage to the Catholic Church as Martin Luther had. Henry became convinced that the reason he hadn't had a son was that he should never have married his brother's widow, so God was cross. He found a passage from Leviticus to back this theory up. He told his chief minister, Cardinal Thomas Wolsey, to persuade the Pope to get his marriage to Catherine annulled, so that in the eyes of God and the Church, it had never happened. They'd just been fucking, and their little princess, who was called Mary, was a bastard. Wolsey was an exceptionally capable man. Despite genuinely humble origins, he had risen to become the country's second richest and second most powerful figure. In a hereditary absolute monarchy, that's absolutely as far as merit can take you. He was very bright and very diligent. It is to Henry's credit that he saw this and used it without pausing to consider whether he should have a first minister who was posher. He couldn't have picked a more effective or less troublesome man than Wolsey. He always said yes to the king, and then he always made it happen. Sadly, however, he couldn't achieve the impossible, and that's what the papal annulment of Henry and Catherine's marriage turned out to be. On paper, it shouldn't have been that hard. Popes had sorted out divorces for kings many times in the past. Eleanor of Aquitaine's marriage to Louis VII of France is a good example. It was annulled by Pope Eugene III after 15 years and two daughters on the basis of consanguinity. Sounds like a sensible reason, but then loads of royal marriages were a bit too incestuous. That was routinely tolerated, but it could be used as an excuse when the real reasons were less clear-cut. In the case of Louis and Eleanor, it was that they totally hated one another. Had the Pope been amenable to helping the defender of the faith's tricky dynastic situation, then the bit of Leviticus would have provided justification enough. Then there wouldn't have been a break with Rome, and William Shakespeare would have been a second-rate sculptor. But the Pope wasn't amenable and found a bit of Deuteronomy that said the opposite to the bit of Leviticus. Was that because he preferred Deuteronomy to Leviticus? No, it was because he preferred Charles V, who was at this time pretty much in charge of Italy, hanging around with lots of troops while eating spaghetti in horrendous new ways, to Henry VIII, who had no power south of the Lizard Peninsula and much less than Charles in general. Charles was Catherine of Aragon's nephew, and he didn't take kindly to his dear old aunt being cast aside. The Pope said no. Gradually, mind, it wasn't a flat no. There was lots of chat while Wolsey desperately hoped to get a deal and Henry desperately hoped to have sex with Anne Boleyn and managed to convince himself that, in fact, this was a very holy feeling. Henry eventually lost patience with Wolsey, who was disgraced and, in 1530, died of the stress of it all before Henry had even got round to executing him. Kings of England had fallen out with popes before and at times had been excommunicated. Henry II and John both had their run-ins. But no English king, however irascible and self-confident, had ever done the full "fuck you, I won't do what you tell me," to quote from Rage Against the Machine's 1992 protest hit Killing in the Name, which, if you ask me, would be a much more appropriate piece of music to be associated with Henry VIII than Greensleeves, though neither track reached England until after his death. Why did Henry do what none of his predecessors had dared to do? Was it because he was angrier or hornier or took less shit from foreigners? No, it was just because of the Reformation that was happening in Europe generally. The notion of rejecting the Pope was decidedly fashionable. Suddenly, excommunication didn't make you a pariah, it just put you on the other side of a two-sided debate. Henry was kicking the Pope while he was down. Egged on by reformers, those who had rejected Catholicism far more wholeheartedly than Henry ever did, such as Thomas Cromwell, his chief minister from the early 1530s onwards, and Thomas Cranmer, who became Archbishop of Canterbury in March 1533, but opposed by Catholics, such as Sir Thomas More, all of Henry's ministers seem to have been Thomases. It must have been very confusing, though useful for pinning blame on colleagues. Henry married Anne in January 1533. Then Cranmer, recently installed as Archbishop, with full papal approval, the very last of that sentiment to be forthcoming, annulled Henry's marriage to Catherine, declared his marriage to Anne to be valid, and on the 1st of June crowned her queen. In the Reformation Parliament, which sat from 1529 to 1536, various statutes made all this official, including the Act of Succession, which had Princess Mary declared illegitimate, The Act of Restraint in Appeals, which said that appeals to the Pope in Rome on any matter were now illegal, and in 1534, the Act of Supremacy, which declared Henry to be the supreme head of the Church of England. He was his own Pope, basically. A lot of this legislation, which was pushed through Parliament by Cromwell, was justified by the enjoyable bullshit that England was not a kingdom, but an empire, like the Byzantine Empire or the Holy Roman Empire, just smaller. It always had been one. That was the idea. This conforms to the usual pattern of a radical change spun as restoration of something ancient. Henry found some historians who claimed to have traced the English kingdom back to someone called Brutus, who'd come to Britain, which was then named after him, albeit approximately, all the way from Troy. Yes, ancient Troy, as in the stories, the guys that fell for a fake horse, and then some of them supposedly went off and founded the Roman Empire. They probably didn't really do either of those things, but what they definitely didn't do, ever, is go to England at all. If you were looking for a story to make the one about Joseph of Arimathea coming here with the Holy Grail seem comparatively realistic, then Brutus of Troy founding Brutuan is a good choice. But that's what came out of Henry's historian's brainstorm. If it had been raining that day, they'd probably have said the place was founded by Noah, who'd landed at Noah Quay in Cornwall. What this fabricated backstory meant, they said, was that England and Henry, unlike other kings and kingdoms, were not subject to any external European jurisdiction. The idea that someone on the continent could overrule any aspect of English governance would not be stood for. Sound familiar? The notion of Little Englander exceptionalism was established. This pattern of thinking would develop into a way of bolstering national self-esteem without incurring the expense of attempting to take over France. Three Queens Down. Henry and Anne did not have a happy marriage. She kept answering back, which, you'll be amazed to hear, Henry VIII didn't like, and she gave birth to a daughter, which he liked even less. Also, she managed to fall out with Thomas Cromwell, despite both of them being Protestants, which fact gave them enemies aplenty without needing each other. In January 1536, after 3 years of marriage, the trajectory of Anne and Henry's relationship enjoyed a dead cat bounce when the news of Catherine of Aragon's death broke. They dressed up in yellow, which was the colour of mourning in Catherine's native Spain, but they didn't mean it respectfully. They did a little celebratory victory dance together. This grubby knees-up may have been the last happy moment in the marriage. Anne was pregnant again by this point and had a strong sense that it was extremely important that she give birth to a boy. An attractive, quiet, amenable and deferential young woman called Jane Seymour had started hanging round the court and laughing at the king's jokes, and this made Anne anxious. Then, one day, Henry had a jousting accident in which he hurt his leg and, by one account, was unconscious for 2 hours. The leg injury troubled him for the rest of his life, as it developed into a revolting, purulent ulcer which stank and caused him agony. Some reckon that the unconsciousness damaged his brain and caused him to turn into an intolerant, irascible tyrant. I'm not sure about this, as he wasn't exactly a pussycat before the accident. Henry post-1536 seems to me entirely consistent with the man he was before, just a bit grumpier because he was old, his leg hurt all the time, and he was getting fatter and fatter as a result. The shock of the jousting accident is said to have been what caused Anne to miscarry a male child a few days later. Henry was not very sympathetic and allowed charges of adultery to be trumped up against her. She was executed in May 1536, and Jane Seymour was betrothed to Henry the next day. Jane Seymour was Henry's ideal wife. She didn't argue, she gave birth to a boy, and then she promptly died without his having to kill her. What a catch. Henry claimed to be heartbroken at her passing, but there's a certain amount of self-pity that has to be waded through before we can properly discern the sincerity of the emotion. I'm sure he thought he was very sad, but he'd known wives die before and bounce back very quickly. On the first occasion, he got dressed up in a bright colour and had a party, and on the second, which he had ordered, he was about to get engaged to someone else, so let's keep the size of the violin we play for him under control. This was 1537, and it's important to note that England had changed hugely in the last few years in a way that was freaking a lot of people out. The European Reformation, this huge schism in the Western Christian Church, revolutionised the context in which everything was happening. For centuries there'd been rulers and there'd been the Pope, and they argued or got on well, they denounced each other and made up, and sometimes the one called a crusade and the other trooped off to the Eastern Med for some fighting and diarrhoea. There'd been times when there'd been an anti-pope, i.e. a rival pope that some people considered to be the real pope. But the notion that the real pope just didn't matter and was some sort of diabolical impostor, an unwanted intercessor between God and man who obstructed the salvation provided by the scriptures, was a massive shift. If that's what you believed, then the pope and all devout Roman Catholics were now heretics. And if you were a Catholic, this new evangelical reforming Protestant agenda was itself a worse heresy than Islam. This complete polarisation of views is familiar to us today from social media. Some of the horrendous consequences of the Reformation, such as the 30 Years' War, which raged in Europe during the 17th century and remained unsurpassed in its brutal martial murderousness until 1914, led to a few centuries in which toleration started to be valued as a mindset, and people in the liberal West could agree to differ. That civilised instinct has no place amid the electric mob rule of a Twitter discussion. The loneliness of pariah status will be familiar to many who have neglected to entirely agree with one or other of two savagely opposed points of view. Henry VIII was in just such a lonely position, though he probably didn't realise it. His views were unacceptable to both Catholics and Protestants, too keen on transubstantiation for the latter, too down on the Pope for the former. The English Reformation is weird. It was shaped by the way different religious groups manipulated Henry's needs, desires, and theological musings. The reformers got as much as they could out of him, but were careful not to push their luck. Then the Catholics would try and nudge things back a bit, but were equally careful not to say anything nice about the Pope. One traumatic change that was being implemented by Cromwell was the dissolution of the monasteries. The reformers despised these ancient institutions, and with reason. They were often corrupt and hypocritical. Still, they had been part of the fabric of English life for a lot longer than a sole English monarchy, let alone a parliament. Getting rid of them was bound to cause trauma. The reformers dreamed of the monastery's vast wealth being used to improve the conditions of the people. The Catholics, conversely, considered their ancient role of praying for humanity's salvation, as well as providing vital services such as alms and medicine, to be irreplaceable. The compromise that was reached was to get rid of them, but for the crown to keep all their wealth, for Henry to build palaces and wage wars. This was how Cromwell got the king on side with the plan. The process was made all the more sickening for religious conservatives and members of monastic institutions because it happened in two waves. A large number of smaller monasteries were dissolved in 1536, and then the remaining smaller number of large ones got closed down in 1538. In between, there were rebellions and, in general, outpourings of national agony, most notably a vast uprising in the north called the Pilgrimage of Grace. These are a reminder of how quick and radical the changes were. The whole rationale of religious existence was suddenly transformed, and by a diktat from central government rather than through any grassroots evolution of religious feeling. However flawed many of the monasteries were, this imposition was bound to appall and frighten many. The uprisings caused stress for Henry and Cromwell, and for the rest of the reign, the king was constantly worried that some sort of rebellion would break out and be supported by an invasion from a great Catholic continental ruler, most likely Charles V. It didn't happen, though, because Henry, whatever he thought, was a pretty lucky guy. Was the dissolution of the monasteries the moment when England started to become accustomed to the unsettling effect of what its authority figures insist is progress? It often struck me as a lamentable trait in the modern British, and I think it manifests most in England, of glumly accepting change that no one likes or wants. Post office closures, the decline in manufacture, the decimation of shops and pubs in high streets, the requirement to do everything online. These are developments that very few of us like, but the consensus seems to be that we need to grow up and take it. Things can't be nice. This is the real world. That's life. Shit happens. Nothing pleasant can be made economically viable. The French don't take the same view. They're much happier using their collective power to sustain a way of life they like. Hence, they have a law which prevents people from staying at their desk in an office over lunch. An actual law. I only know about it because during the COVID lockdown, it was temporarily suspended on the basis that all the restaurants and cafes were closed. Imagine having a law about something like that. Don't work at your desk. Get out and have a proper lunch. Go to a brasserie or go home and cook. The food will be nicer and so will your experience of the day, one of a finite number you will live through. We'd never vote for a government proposing that sort of law in England. It would get condemned as nanny state. The notion of freedom, of English exceptionalism, would be deployed by the harsh anti-protectionist right, and we'd dutifully carry on eating sandwiches over our keyboards, gradually developing ulcers, and then at the weekend moaning that there aren't any decent places to eat round here. Two of these queens actually make it. Cromwell was riding high in 1539 when he organised the king's next marriage to someone called Anne of Cleves. Her father was the Duke of Cleves, and this was part of Cromwell's plan to cement an alliance with the leading Protestant states of Western Europe. He dispatched the great painter Hans Holbein the Younger to do a portrait of Anne to show to Henry. The king responded enthusiastically to the portrait, which is interesting because I wouldn't say it looked exactly sexy. It wouldn't make it into a Pirelli calendar. It's quite a plain picture of a normal-looking woman dressed extremely oddly. The oddness of the dress is to do with it being the 16th century, so we have to ignore that. Almost everyone I mention in this book dressed very strangely by our standards. All in all, it's not a picture that would make you rule out marrying its subject, but it wouldn't clinch the deal for me. Nevertheless, it clinched the deal for Henry, and a marriage was organised. Poor Anne travelled to England all nervous and excited, and then Henry took one look at her and decided he didn't fancy her at all. But he still married her a few days later, which seems to me to compound the awkwardness. Henry couldn't get it up and decided that was entirely Anne's fault and not his for being a boozy old fatso with a rotting leg. By the standards of most relationships, Anne was quite badly treated. By the standards of Henry's wives, she's probably second luckiest. The marriage was swiftly annulled, and for the rest of her life she lived in England in quiet retirement, accorded the status of the king's beloved sister. Nevertheless, the whole episode was pretty embarrassing for floppy-cocked Henry, so Cromwell's days were numbered. In April 1540, in the wake of the Cleves fiasco, he was made Earl of Essex, a meteoric elevation for a man whose background was just as humble as Wolsey's. But it seems Henry was just toying with him. 2 months later, he was arrested, attainted, and on the 28th of July, executed. Henry didn't watch it happen because he was getting married that day. Henry's fifth queen was Catherine Howard, niece of the Duke of Norfolk. The Howards are still the Dukes of Norfolk today, and they're also still Catholics, so you won't be surprised to learn that Henry's new marriage and Cromwell's demise were signs that a conservative faction was on the rise at court. The king soon regretted this shift. He never had a minister as capable as Cromwell again, and Catherine Howard was as unfaithful as Anne Boleyn was accused of being. She was executed in 1542. But the bloated, wheezing, rotting, increasingly enraged and immobile old romantic hadn't given up on love. The following year, he married Catherine Parr. She was a reformer, so marked a turn away from the Howards' religious conservatism and having sex with other men, but Henry's mood continued to oscillate between Catholic and evangelical in a way that made everyone, even his new queen, episodically fear for their lives. Catherine seems to have been an intelligent, humane woman who managed to make the old wreck of a king feel attractive and loved. She was also instrumental in reconciling him with all his children. His daughter by Anne Boleyn had been removed from the succession and declared a bastard by Act of Parliament, just as her half-sister Princess Mary had been. But under a third Succession Act in 1543, all of the king's children, by his various marriages, were legitimised and returned to the line of succession. One great big, extremely fucked-up family. They would now have the same inheritance rights